So, listener, last week in my show about dreams, I left you with a bit of a cliffhanger about the shadow aspect of our personality that often appears to us in our dreams, in some ogre-like or other metaphorical form. It's the aspect of our personality that we don't like to expose to the light of day, but it's a very important aspect of our personality that maybe needs to be integrated into our waking life. As you're going to hear in tonight's The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on this Laguna's one and only FM radio station, KX935. The shadow came to light, as it were, through the famous psychologist, psychiatrist, and psychoanalyst, Carl Jung. And you're going to hear from Jung himself, an old interview he did many decades ago. Many psychologists and people involved in our mental well-being have looked into this shadow aspect of our personality in terms of how it forms us and how we should cope with it. I'm going to start tonight's show with Carolyn Mays, who's spoken extensively on topics of mental well-being. But just a quick word before that from where I left off on last week's show with dream and shadow expert Charlie Morley.
The shadow is a concept pioneered by Carl Jung, used to describe the parts of the unconscious mind made up of all the undesirable aspects of our psyches, which we have rejected, denied, or disowned. The shadow is our dark side, but a side of ourselves on which Jung himself commented that, in spite of its function as a reservoir for human darkness, or perhaps because of this, the shadow is the seat of all human creativity. The shadow is not bad. The shadow is a potential wellspring of creative energy. But because it's the part of ourselves which is incompatible with who we think we are, most of us go through life denying its existence. And so we go through life denying and rejecting a large part of ourselves. But Jung believed that until we recognize and acknowledge the shadow as part of us, we will never be whole.
Think of the shadow as the parts of yourself that you don't know much about, that circumstances in life activate. And so the shadow is neither good nor bad, it's neutral. But if you don't investigate shadow, then shadow will cause trouble. And it is capable of profoundly painful activity in your life. The shadow part of us can participate in very destructive behavior. And it is very definitely at times conscious. So to say our shadow self does something as if to say we're not conscious of our shadow is not true at all. You know, for example, when you are feeling jealous. What you don't know is how jealous you are capable of being. And that when pushed to ultimate jealousy, what that unknown part is capable of doing. That's where the shadow lives. It's in the unknown part of parts of yourself you do know. All of us know what we're capable of doing when we're angry. And yet there's a part of us that knows, I won't let myself get that angry because past that point, I'm not sure what I'll do. That's where your shadow is. It's in that part of yourself that you are not quite sure you can control. And everybody has that part. And that part of ourselves has its hands on mechanisms in us. It has itself on triggers. And we don't always know what those triggers are, but they get triggered. And those triggers include certain people in our lives, certain relationships can trigger our shadow, just like we can for others. We trigger their shadow, their darkest part. There's something about us that brings out in them their shadow. There's certain things in our life that trigger the worst of us, just like some things activate the best of us. And it's in our best interest to pursue the shadow, to do what we can to excavate it. And it's also, without a doubt, the most challenging thing we can do.
Sound familiar, listener? I mean, come on, it's holiday time. Family time, extended family time. And who knows our triggers better than people that we've lived with for long portions of our lives? The people who think they know us better than we know ourselves. And maybe they do. and maybe they accept us in all our colours more than we accept ourselves. Living away from them, we've maybe managed to create a far more lovable persona, lovable to us, that is, than the one they feel entitled to appropriate for us. The key is they are probably able to love us despite ourselves more than we are. I'm going to play you in a minute Jung's thoughts on his own understanding of the shadow self from an old interview he did before he died in the middle of the last century. And even he fesses up to not quite understanding the shadow self. He was more concerned with accepting the shadow sides of ourselves so that we didn't play out those darker instincts by transferring them onto other people. Once we recognized what we harbored inside us in terms of what we feared and therefore hated in ourselves, instead of turning it on others, the best remedy would be to disincorporate the good, the bad, the ugly as just part of the whole package. Have a listen now to Alan Watts, who is known for incorporating Eastern philosophy into a more Western sphere. He was a fan of Jung. What you're going to hear was recorded half a century ago, so the sound quality isn't great, but I think the content is very interesting. The shadow self is the topic of my sharing hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935.
I think the most important thing in Jung is that he was able to point out that to the degree that you condemn others and find evil in others, you are to that degree unconscious of the same thing in yourself, or at least of the potentiality of it. There can be Eichmanns and Hitlers and Himmlers just because there are people who are unconscious of their own dark sides, and they project that darkness outward into, say, Jews or communists or whatever the enemy may be, and say, there is the darkness, it is not in me. And therefore, because the darkness is not in me, I am justified in annihilating this enemy, whether it be with atom bombs or gas chambers or whatnot. But to the degree that a person becomes conscious that the evil is as much in himself as in the other, to this same degree he is not likely to project it onto some scapegoat and to commit the most criminal acts of violence upon other people. Now this is to me the primary thing that Jung saw, that in order to admit and really accept and understand the evil in oneself, one had to be able to do it without being an enemy to it. As he put it, you had to accept your own dark side. And he had this preeminently in his own character. I had a long talk with him back in 1958, and I was enormously impressed with a man who's obviously very great, but at the same time, with whom everyone could be completely at ease. There are so many great people, great in knowledge or great in what is called holiness, with whom the ordinary individual feels rather embarrassed. He feels inclined to sit on the edge of his chair and to feel immediately judged by this person's wisdom or sanctity. Jung managed to have wisdom, and I think also sanctity, in such a way that when other people came into its presence, they didn't feel judged. They felt enhanced, encouraged, and invited to share in a common life. And there was a sort of twinkle in Jung's eye that gave me the impression that he knew himself to be just as much a villain as everybody else. There's a nice German word, Hintergedanke, which means a thought in the very far, far back of your mind. Jung had a Hintergedanke in the back of his mind, which showed. It showed in the twinkle in his eye. It showed that he knew and recognized what I've sometimes called the element of irreducible rascality in himself. And he knew it so strongly and so clearly, and in a way so lovingly, that he would not condemn the same thing in others, and therefore would not be led into those thoughts, feelings, and acts of violence towards others, which are always characteristic of the people who project the devil in themselves, upon the outside, upon somebody else, upon the scapegoat. Now this made Jung a very integrated character. In other words, here I have to present a little bit of a complex idea. He was a man who was thoroughly with himself.
Do you remember the occasion when you first felt consciousness of your own individual self?
That was in my 11th year. I stepped out of a mist. Suddenly, on my way to school, it was just as if I had been walking in a mist, not knowing to differentiate myself from things. I was just one thing among many things. And I stepped out of it and I knew I am. I am what I am.
Was that associated with any particular episode in your life, or was it just a normal function of adolescence?
Well, that's difficult to say. As far as I can remember, nothing had happened before that would explain this sudden coming to consciousness.
You hadn't, for instance, been quarrelling with your parents or anything?
No,
no,
no.
It's always weird to think of great men as 11-year-olds, isn't it? Sounds like Carl Jung was already pretty great at 11. This is an interview he did with John Freeman, brought to you tonight on this The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935.
What memories have you of your parents? Were they strict and old-fashioned in the way they brought you up?
Oh, well, you know, they belonged to the later parts of the Middle Ages. My father was a parson in the country, and you can imagine what people were then, you know, in the 70s of the past century. They had the convictions in which people have lived since 1,800 years.
How did he try to impress these convictions on you? Did he punish you, for instance?
Oh, no, not at all. No, he was very liberal. And he was most tolerant, most understanding.
Which did you get on with more intimately, your father or your mother?
That's difficult to say. Of course, one is always more intimate with the mother. But when it comes to the personal feeling, I had a better relation to my father, who was predictable, than with my mother, who was, to me, very problematical.
Fear was not an element in your relation with your father?
Not at all.
Did you accept him as being infallible in his judgments?
Oh, no, I knew he was very fallible.
How old were you when you knew that?
Now, let me see. Perhaps 11 or 12 years old. It was hanging together with the fact that I was, that I knew I was. And from then on, I saw that my father is different.
So the moment of self-revelation was closely connected with realizing the fallibility of your parents?
Yes, one could say so. But I realized that I had fear of my mother, but not during the day. There she was quite known to me and predictable, but in the night I had fear of my mother.
Can you remember why? Can you remember what that
period? I have not the slightest idea why. No.
Having seen and accepted his own nature profoundly, he had a kind of unity and absence of conflict in his own nature, which had to it this additional complication that I find so fascinating. He was the sort of man who could feel anxious and afraid and guilty without being ashamed of feeling this way. In other words, he understood that an integrated person is not a person who simply eliminated the sense of guilt or the sense of anxiety from his life, who is fearless and wooden and kind of sage of stone. He's a person who feels all these things, but has no recrimination against himself for feeling them. And this is, to my mind, a profound kind of humor. Al Capp made the point that he felt that all humor was fundamentally malicious. Now, there's a very high kind of humor, which is humor at oneself. A real humor is not jokes at the expense of others. It's always jokes at the expense of oneself, and of course it has an element of malice in it. It has malice towards oneself, the recognition of the fact that behind the social role that you assume, behind all your pretensions to being either a good citizen or a fine scholar or a great scientist or a leading politician or physician or whatever you happen to be, that behind this facade there is a certain element of the unreconstructed bum. Not as something to be condemned and wailed over, but as something to be recognized as contributive to one's greatness and to one's positive aspects in the same way that manure is contributive to the perfume of the rose. Jung saw this and Jung accepted this.
We need more understanding of human nature, because the only real danger that exists is man himself. He is the great danger, and we are pitifully unaware of it.
Heaven help me for the way I am. Save me from these evil deeds before I get them done. I know tomorrow brings the consequence at hand, but I keep living this day like the next will never come. Oh, help me, but don't tell me to deny.
Psychology. We know nothing of man, far too little. His psyche should be studied because we are the origin of all coming evil.
Strong words from Jung himself. Carl Jung, of course, was the psychologist and psychoanalyst who created the concept of the shadow, the darker side of ourselves lurking there and often only manifesting itself in our dreams. The shadow is the topic of my The Sharon Hour tonight with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. And I'm currently playing you an interview that John Freeman did with Jung. You can tell by the term he uses for psychiatrist, i.e. alienist, how old this interview is. So hopefully you'll forgive the sound quality.
Now, when the time came that you qualified as a doctor, what made you decide to specialize in being an alienist?
It's rather an interesting point. Well, I had finished my studies practically, and I didn't know what I really wanted to do. I had a big chance to follow one of my professors. He was called to a new position in Munich, and he wanted me as his assistant. But then I studied for my final examination. I came across a textbook of psychiatry. Up to then, I thought nothing about it, because our professor then wasn't particularly interesting. And I only read the introduction to that book, where certain things were said about psychosis as a maladjustment of the personality. That hit the nail on the head. Also, the idea of doing something useful with human beings appealed to me. In that moment, I saw I must become an alienist. My heart was thumping wildly in that moment. And when I told my professor I wouldn't follow him, I would study psychiatry, he couldn't understand it. Nor my friends, because in those days psychiatry was nothing, nothing at all. But I saw the one great chance to unite certain contrasting things in myself, namely, besides natural science, I always had studied history of philosophy and such subjects. It was just as if suddenly two streams were joining. that led me into my later investigation of psychological types. There are definite attitudes. Some people are doing it in this way and other people are doing it in another typical way.
Have you concluded what psychological type you are yourself?
Naturally, I have devoted a great deal of attention to that painful question, you know.
And reached a conclusion?
Well, you see, the type is nothing static. It changes in the course of life. But I most certainly was characterized by thinking. I always thought, from early childhood on. And I had a great deal of intuition, too. And I had a definite difficulty with feeling. And my relation to reality was not particularly brilliant. I was often at variance with the reality of things. Now, that gives you all the necessary data for the diagnosis.
Do you consider that Freud's standard of proof and experimentation was less high than your own?
Well, you see, that is an evaluation I'm not competent of. I am not my own history. With reference to certain results, I think my method has its merits.
Tell me, did Freud himself ever analyze you?
Oh, yes. I had submitted quite a lot of my dreams to him. And so did he.
And he to you, yes.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes.
Do you remember now, at this distance of time, what were the significant features of Freud's dreams that you noted at the time?
Well, that is rather indiscreet to ask, you know, if there is such a thing as a professional secret.
He's been dead these many years.
Yeah, yes, but these regards last longer than life.
The rule of confidentiality between doctor and patient, it even exists between psychoanalyst and psychoanalyst, between Jung and Freud. Jung's The Shadow Concept is the topic of my share in our tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Gunas KX935. Sometimes the line between your obligation to reveal psychotic behavior that could have consequences outside the psychiatrist's office must cause pause.
I want to read a passage from one of Jung's lectures delivered to a group of clergy in Switzerland, a considerable number of years ago, which I think is one of the greatest things he ever wrote. He writes as follows. People forget that even doctors have moral scruples, and that certain patients' confessions are hard even for a doctor to swallow. Yet the patient does not feel himself accepted, unless the very worst in him is accepted too. No one can bring this about by mere words. It comes only through reflection, and through the doctor's attitude towards himself and his own dark side. If the doctor wants to guide another, or even accompany him a step of the way, he must feel with that person's psyche. He never feels it when he passes judgment. Whether he puts his judgments into words or keeps them to himself makes not the slightest difference. To take the opposite position and to agree with the patient offhand is also of no use. Feeling comes only through unprejudiced objectivity. This sounds almost like a scientific precept, and it could be confused with a purely intellectual, abstract attitude of mind. But what I mean is something quite different. It is a human quality, a kind of deep respect for the facts, for the man who suffers from them, and for the riddle of such a man's life. The truly religious person has this attitude. He knows that God has brought all sorts of strange and inconceivable things to pass, and seeks in the most curious ways to enter a man's heart. He therefore senses in everything the unseen presence of the divine will. This is what I mean by unprejudiced objectivity. It is a moral achievement on the part of the doctor, who ought not to let himself be repelled by sickness and corruption. We cannot change anything unless we accept it. Condemnation does not liberate, it oppresses. I am the oppressor of the person I condemn, not his friend and fellow sufferer. I do not in the least mean to say that we must never pass judgment when we desire to help and improve. But if the doctor wishes to help a human being, he must be able to accept him as he is. And he can do this in reality only when he has already seen and accepted himself as he is. Perhaps this sounds very simple, but simple things are always the most difficult. In actual life, it requires the greatest art to be simple, and so acceptance of oneself is the essence of the moral problem and the acid test of one's whole outlook on life. That I feed the beggar, that I forgive an insult, that I love my enemy, all these are undoubtedly great virtues. What I do unto the least of my brethren, that I do unto Christ. But what if I should discover that the least amongst them all, the poorest of all beggars, the most impudent of all offenders, yea, the very fiend himself, that these are within me, and that I myself stand in need of the alms of my own kindness, that I myself am the enemy who must be loved, what then? Then, as a rule, the whole truth of Christianity is reversed. There is then no more talk of love and long-suffering. We condemn and rage against ourselves. We hide him from the world. We deny ever having met this least among the lowly in ourselves. And had it been God himself who drew near to us in this despicable form, we should have denied him 1,000 times before a single cock had crowed. Well, you may think the metaphors rather strong, but I feel that they are not so needlessly. This is a very, very forceful passage, and a memorable one in all Jung's works. Trying to heal this insanity, from which our culture in particular has suffered, of thinking that a human being can become hale, healthy, and holy by being divided against himself in inner conflict, paralleling the conception of a cosmic conflict between an absolute good and an absolute evil, which cannot be reduced to any prior and underlying unity. In other words, our rage, and our very proper rage, against evil things which occur in this world. If we require as a justification for our rage a fundamental and metaphysical division between good and evil, we have an insane and, in a certain sense, schizophrenic universe of which no sense whatsoever can be made. All conflict, Jung was saying, all opposition has its resolution in an underlying unity. You cannot understand the meaning of to be unless you understand the meaning of not to be. You cannot understand the meaning of good unless you understand the meaning of evil. This is not, as Jung tries to explain, a philosophy of condoning the evil. To take the opposite position, he said, and to agree with the patient offhand is also of no use, but estranges him, the patient, as much as condemnation.
So this idea promulgated by Jung of accepting and assimilating your shadow self, the underside, maybe the less likable part of you, the side that frightens you about yourself, was something necessary to do without too much judgment. Obviously, we're not supposed to enact our worst instincts, but knowing they're there and can be triggered is better than being ignorant of them and having them surprise us. Would seem to make sense. It's not as if the shadow self doesn't exist in all of us and isn't part of the makeup of the world, Jung suggests, because how could we know right if we don't know wrong? How do we know good if we don't know evil? And if we don't know it in ourselves, how are we equipped to deal with it in the world at large? The shadow self is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. I'm currently playing you a talk by Alan Watts, who was a spiritualist, if you like, and admired Jung, and is here quoting from a lecture Jung gave.
The modern man's heard enough about guilt and sin. He is sorely beset by his own bad conscience, and wants rather to know how he is to reconcile himself with his own nature, how he is to love the enemy in his own heart and call the wolf his brother. The modern man does not want to know in what way he can imitate Christ, but in what way he can live his own individual life, however meager and uninteresting it may be. It is because every form of imitation seems to him deadening and sterile that he rebels against the force of tradition that would hold him to well-trodden ways. All such roads for him lead in the wrong direction. He may not know it, but he behaves as if his own individual life were God's special will which must be fulfilled at all costs. This is the source of his egoism, which is one of the most tangible evils of the neurotic state. But the person who tells him he is too egoistic has already lost his confidence, and rightly so, for that person has driven him still further into his neurosis. If I wish to effect a cure for my patients, I am forced to acknowledge the deep significance of their egoism. I should be blind indeed if I did not recognize it as a true will of God. I must even help the patient to prevail in his egoism. If he succeeds in this, he estranges himself from other people. He drives them away, and they come to themselves, as they should, for they were seeking to rob him of his sacred egoism. This must be left to him, for it is his strongest and healthiest power. It is, as I have said, a true will of God, which sometimes drives him into complete isolation. However wretched this state may be, it also stands him in good stead. For in this way alone can he get to know himself and learn what an invaluable treasure is the love of his fellow beings. It is, moreover, only in the state of complete abandonment and loneliness that we experience the helpful powers of our own natures. End of quote. This is a very striking example of Jung's power to comprehend and integrate points of view as well as psychological attitudes that seem on the surface to be completely antithetical. For example, even in his own work, when he was devoting himself to the study of Eastern philosophy, he had some difficulty in comprehending the, let's say, the Buddhistic denial of the reality of the ego. But you can see that in practice, in what he was actually trying to get at, he was moving towards the same position that is intended in both the Hindu and the Buddhist philosophy about the nature of the ego. Just, for example, as the Hindu will say, that the I principle in man is not really a separate ego, but an expression of the universal life of the Godhead. So Jung is saying here that the development of the ego in man is a true will of God, and that it is only by following the ego and developing it to its full extent that one fulfills the function which this, you might say, temporary illusion has in man's psychic life. For he goes on and says here, when one has several times seen this development at work, one can no longer deny that what was evil has turned to good, and that what seemed good has kept alive the forces of evil. The archdemon of egoism leads us along the royal road to that ingathering which religious experience demands. What we observe here is a fundamental law of life, enantiodromia, or conversion into the opposite. And it is this that makes possible the reunion of the warring halves of the personality, and thereby brings the civil war to an end. End of quote. In other words, he was seeing that, as Blake said, a fool who persists in his folly will become wise. That the development of egoism in man is not something to be overcome or better integrated by opposition to it, but by following it. It's almost, isn't it, the principle of judo, not overcoming what appears to be a hostile force by opposing it, but by swinging with the punch or rolling with the punch. And so by following the ego transcends itself. And in this moment of insight, the great Westerner, by going along consistently with this principle, comes to the same position as the Easterner. That is to say, to the point of view where one sees conflict, which at first sight had seemed absolute, as resting upon a primordial unity, and thereby attaining a profound, unshakable peace of the heart, which can nevertheless contain conflict, not a peace that is simply static and lifeless.
Jung discovered his own darker side, his shadow self, in his school days, where it appeared he was maligned and bullied. The shadow self is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight, here on KX935 with me, Sharon James.
I had a difficulty with certain teachers I remember one case where the teacher had the habit to discuss the papers written by the pupils, and he took the best first, and he went through the whole number of the pupils, and I didn't appear, and I was badly troubled over it, and I thought, well, it is impossible that my thesis can be that bad. And when he had finished, he said, there is still one paper left over, and that is the one by Jung. That would be by far the best paper if it hadn't been copied. He has just copied it somewhere, stolen. You are a thief, Jung. And if I knew where you have stolen it, I would fling you out of school. And I got mad and I said, this is the one thesis where I have worked the most, because the theme was interesting, in contradistinction, you know, to other themes of genre, not at all interesting to me. And then he said, you are a liar. And if you can prove that you have stolen that thing somewhere, then you get out of school. Now, that was a very serious thing to me, because what else then, you see? I hated that fellow, and that was the only man I could have killed, you know. If I had met him once at a dark corner, I would have shown him something of what I could do.
Did you often have violent thoughts about people when you were young?
No, not exactly. Only when I got mad. Well, then I beat them up.
And did you often get mad?
Not so often, but then for good.
You were very strong and big, I imagine.
Yes, I was pretty strong. And, you know, reared in the country with those peasant boys, it was a rough kind of life. And I would have been capable of violence, I know. I was a bit afraid of it. So I rather tried to avoid the critical situations because I didn't trust myself. Once I was attacked by about seven boys, and I got mad. And I took one and just swung him round with his legs, you know, and beat down four of them. And then they were satisfied.
And were there any consequences from that afterwards?
Oh, I should say, yes. From then on, I was always suspected that I was at the bottom of every trouble. I was not, but they were afraid, and I was never attacked again.
Worshipping. I am raw, a dinosaur, but I will never be extinct. So don't mess with me. I'll shoot you down. Don't mess with me. And if you want me, you'd better contact my people. See my crown, I am king. You'll love the endless worshipping. I am raw, a dinosaur, but I will never be extinct. So don't mess with me. I'll shoot you down. Don't mess with me. I'll knock you down. Don't mess with me. I'll shoot you down, don't mess with me.
interesting how this mild-spoken, brilliant man, master of minds, understood the power of his shadow self while merely assimilating it into his life without seemingly exploiting it. The shadow self, a theory promulgated by Carl Jung, is the topic of my share now tonight. That's for me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. And you're listening to a very candid interview he did with John Freeman in the middle of the last century. Thank God for these archives that we can now access quite easily. It's wonderful to hear the voice of Jung himself, so many years on, detailing his theories for us.
We are shaped through the influence of the parents, which are by no means always personal. They were prejudiced or they were influenced by historical ideas or what I call dominance. And that is a most decisive factor in psychology. We are not of today or of yesterday. We are of an immense age. It was partially my experience with schizophrenic patients that led me to the idea of certain general historical conditions.
Is there any one case that you can now look back on and feel that perhaps it was the turning point of your thought?
Oh, yes. I made quite a number of experiences of that sort, and I went even to Washington to study at the psychiatric clinic there. And I can tell you an example. We had a patient in the ward. He was quiet, but completely dissociated, schizophrenic. And he was in the clinic already for over 20 years. He had come into the clinic, as a matter of fact, a young man, did no particular education. And once I came into the ward, and he was obviously excited and called to me, took me by the lapel of my coat and led me to the window and said, "Doctor, now you must see. Now look at it. Look up at the sun and see how it moves. See, you must move your head too like this. And then you will see the follows of the sun. And, you know, that's the origin of the wind. And you see how the sun moves as you move your head from one side to the other." Now, of course, I didn't understand it at all. I thought, there you are, he's just crazy. But that case remained in my mind. And 4 years later, I came across a paper written by the German historian Dietrich, who had dealt with the so-called Mithras liturgy, a part of the great Parisian sorcerer papyrus. And there he produced a part of the so-called Mithras liturgy. Namely, it is said there, "After the second prayer, thou wilt see how the disk of the sun unfolds, and you will see hanging down from it the tube, the origin of the wind. And when you move thy face and face the regions of the east, it will move there. And if you move your face to the region of the west, it will follow you." And instantly I knew, now this is it. This is the vision of my patient.
But how could you be sure that your patient wasn't unconsciously recalling something that somebody had told him?
Oh, no, quite out of question, because that thing was not known. It wasn't even published. It was only published 4 years later after I had observed it with my patient.
And this, you felt, proved that there was an unconscious, which was something more than personal.
Oh, well, that was not a proof to me, but it was a hint. And I took the hint.
Ever low key. So, the shadow, then, which is the topic of my share now tonight, that's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, can be something out of this world, something psychotic, or something enlightened, something that exists in our subconscious that we maybe have pushed out of our life or run from. Maybe it's some untapped brilliance, something creative that we didn't know existed in us. It seems in all events it's something we should not ignore.
I believe deeply that if someone said, define the spiritual life in one way, you only get one definition, I would say it's the sacred path of the shadow. Because you need every ounce of the sacred to pursue the shadow in you. It is the pursuit of the darkest part of you with the lightest strength in you. I myself had to grow into the awareness of what a shadow attack is for me, because after a workshop, people would want to hug me. And after I'd come back from a workshop, I always felt absolutely horrible. I wasn't shaking physically, but I recognized that I was actually kind of in a state where I couldn't sit still. I was vibrationally hysterical. That's the only way I could put it. Just so angry. So it had expressed itself as a anger beyond personal. And if some close friend had said, "What are you so angry about?" I would say, I don't know. Because there's nothing in my personal level. It's an impersonal vibrational anger. Eventually, what I recognized is that I could not be touched by anybody at a workshop, because they approached me with a psychic agenda. They all wanted to speak to me. They all wanted to have a reading, and I could not accommodate any of that. I mean, there's 2,000 of them and there's one of me. But in their embracing, they were thinking that. And somehow, in a way that we don't know yet, we don't understand, but it transitioned into my energy field. Some form of the psychic free radicals came into my energy system. And I carried it. And I would feel myself, with every hug, getting more and more hostile. How I expressed it and how I manifested was hostility. And in this way, and this is something that may sound paradoxical to you, my shadow protected me. Until I understood why I was getting this way, because it was unconscious, because I didn't understand, until it came out into the light, until I understood it, my shadow had to do it for me. And so I attacked. And I would suddenly go from one temperament to the next, just like as if I was a car going at full speed that instantly ran out of steam. And I became toxic and became, "Don't touch me. Just, I got to get out of here. I've got to get out of here. I mean, right now, I've got to get out." And when I finally understood, it came into the light, and I finally understood that part of me, I changed the rules. We have to. Otherwise, the shadow attacks happen. And I said, "Please, I don't want to be touched. This is just a thing that I have to respect in myself. As much as I'd love to hug you, I can't. Please don't come near me that way." Now I deal with it in the light. I can do it with love. Why do we need the shadow? There you go. This is a mild version. Our shadow has darker and darker aspects to it, of course. Why do people abuse other people? Why do some people refuse to love? One of the darkest parts of our shadow is when someone we love and they love us, but then they withhold love. They withhold it. It would be so simple to just say to someone, "You look wonderful. You'll be great. Congratulations on your book. Congratulations on this." For some people, it's the hardest thing in the world to validate. They can't bear to empower someone. Empowering another human being is one of the most challenging things in life for human beings. That's in your shadow. You have to look at that. Why can't I give that to another person? Why do I limit that? Why do I think that if I empower someone else, it lessens my power? It lessens me. I learned when I did a lot of seeking out money for organizations, universities that needed money for grants. I had to deal with people who were billionaires. And I remember one in particular, the most selfish person I've ever met in my life. But that person taught me something about shadow. And that's that at some point we go from well-off to rich to wealthy to mega, uber. And I hear people say all the time, and this is archetypal, how much money do they need? But something switches in people, and that's when the shadow takes over. And when the shadow takes over is at the point where the archetype shifts from the management of money to the management of power. And when that happens, the person then is not dealing with their capacity to give money, but to withhold power. And now they're looking through the lens archetypally of the shadow. And when you are asking for money to help empower others in education, they archetypally are hearing, will you please give me power to help empower these people? And what they are actually hearing through their shadow is, if I give you power, then they will have the power to challenge my power. So the wealthier they are, oftentimes for some of these people, the more threatened they are, which is how the policies in our society become more and more aimed toward disempowering. As the 1% gets tighter, they become more frightened of the general population. This is the collective shadow against the collective light. Everything is the dance between the light and the shadow. I cannot encourage you enough to learn to speak shadow and light. Do the work. It is the key to understanding everything, the dance in our society from the dance in you. It is the archetype of language of life itself, the yin, the yang, the light, the dark, the sun and the moon. It is in every cell tissue. It is in every activity in the society. It is in every action you take. It is in every choice you make. We are light. We are shadow.
So we're being advised to embrace our shadow self. Even though it's not conventionally lovable, it's an integral part of us. And here from Charlie Morley again, the dream and shadow expert who started us off on tonight's KX935's The Sharer Now. You're about to hear how he feels about the shadow and how he took the concept of embracing it rather literally.
The shadow is a potential wellspring of creative energy. But because it's the part of ourselves which is incompatible with who we think we are, most of us go through life denying its existence. And so we go through life denying and rejecting a large part of ourselves. But Jung believed that until we recognize and acknowledge the shadow as part of us, we will never be whole. So, I'm having a lucid dream, and the shadow turns up, and it means business. The shadow had manifested as a full-on three-headed demon, radiating pure darkness. Fully lucid dream is often not very dreamlike at all. So there I am, face-to-face with this demon, fully lucid, so I know I'm in my own head, and I know there's no real threat, but it's still pretty scary, so instinctively, I get ready to fight. And then it hits me. Hang on. This must be an aspect of my shadow. I've got to integrate this thing. I've got to embrace this thing. How do I do that exactly? I will give it a hug. So I run up to this thing in the lucid dream and I bear hug it. This dream was so realistic. I could feel it struggling against my embrace. I could feel its breath breathing down my neck. You know, the shadow is the sum total of all your repressed capacity for violence and aggression. So as you can imagine, it's not much of a hugger. But there I am, and I'm hugging this thing that does not want to be hugged, and it's struggling to get away, and I'm clinging on for dear life, and then it does something really unexpected. It starts to shrink. Within my embrace, this big three-headed shadow monster starts to shrink. And I keep holding on and it keeps shrinking and then it stops. And there's a moment of stillness. I release my embrace and I realize I'm hugging myself. This three-headed demon has transformed into me. Carbon copy of me. And there I am face to face with myself. Maybe for the first time in my life. And I woke up in floods of tears. Not only am I in tears, but I've got this weird feeling in my belly, as if a knot has been untied. Some deep emotional knot that had been there for so long, I'd forgotten it was there at all. I don't know what part of my psyche that shadow aspect represented. Maybe some denied childhood trauma, maybe some disowned emotional complex, who knows? But what I do know is that when I was embracing that demon, I was embracing some deeper part of myself. And I was engaging the innate healing potential which resides within us all.
We're closer than pages that stick in a book.
My shadow.
We're closer than ripples that play in a brook.
Strolling
wherever you find him, you find me, just look. Closer than a miser or the bloodhound's Delizer, me.
We're closer than smog when it clings
and
to L.A.
I
We're closer to Bobby as to JFK. Not a soul can bust this team in two. We stick together like glue. And when it's a sleeping time,
that's when we rise.
We start to swing,
swing to the skies.
Our clocks don't chime.
What a surprise.
They ring. A ding ding, a happy new year.
And now to repeat what I said at the start, they'll need a large crowbar to break us apart.
We're alone but far from blue. Before we get finished, we'll make the town roar. We'll make all the late spots and then a few more. We'll wind up at Jilly's right after Toots Shore. Life is gonna be a wee wow wee for my shadow and me.
Would you do me a favor?
What do you want now?
Would you mind just taking it one more time?
From the top?
No, from the ending.
Wonderful.
And while we are swinging, to mention a few, we'll drop in at Danny's, the little club too. But wind up at Jilly's, whatever we do,
yeah,
life is gonna be a wee wow wee.
So, our shadow selves, we need to learn to love them, to accept them to some degree. We can start to at least recognize them by paying attention to our dreams, learning how to lucid dream, maybe doing a dream diary the first thing on waking, and then trying to analyze what the metaphors were in our dreams, what our fears were that were maybe being manifest in our dreams. Also, pay attention to the triggers that set us off in waking life. According to Jung and other people who concern themselves with our mental health, turning our back on our shadow selves, our darker sides, or refusing to acknowledge them can do more harm than good, apparently. That's it for my share in our tonight. It was all about our shadow selves. If you want to hear this show again, you can do so on iTunes or podcasts via our website, kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's for the podcast of this show, but do visit our website anyway. Find out about our events coming up. Do also become a member and do just tune in regularly. We have emergency alerts that often make it through the airwaves if they don't make it onto your phone via Alerto C or Nixie. And we have a lot of other shows than this one. Music shows, talk shows. Finally, this is Sharon James wishing you a great week ahead. Hoping you'll come back and listen for more Sharon Hours every Monday night at 9:00.